My name is Keith Beavers, and I just found out that there is blue milk on the market. It's a Star Wars thing. It's blue, it's milk. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to drink it. I'm going to love it. What's going on, wine lovers from the Vine Pair Podcasting Network? This is the Wine 101 Podcast. My name is Keith Beavers, and you know what? I'm the tasting director of Vine Pair. I mention monks, and I mention monasteries all the time. Well, Burgundy is almost like the definition of that idea of monks and monasteries, so we're going to get into it right now. When Burgundy, in its existence, in the form it was at the time, enters into what's known as the Carolingian dynasty, which is ruled by King Charlemagne, which I mentioned in the Bordeaux episode, we go into a European, I guess, a time of stability politically. And what that means is when there's not a lot of wars going on and not a lot of fighting going on, a lot of progress can happen. And within that progress, Burgundy begins to establish itself through the monks, through the monasteries, and we start to see the vineyards that are so famous today begin to form. So let's talk about how that happened, because that's what Burgundy is. Burgundy is all about the word terroir. The monks basically created that word out of thin air. It has no translation in any other language. How did that happen? Around the 3rd and 4th century, you had a lot of monks creating these communities, and they were kind of It wasn't fully formed yet, but the idea of a monastic community began to form. And they were always headed up by what was called an abbot, A-B-B-O-T. It's a word that's a reference to the Aramaic word for father, which is Abba. So the abbot was the father of the monastic community. And monasteries, the word monastery, basically, it's a really interesting translation. Monas is Greek for to live alone, and terion is Greek for a place to do something. So a monastery is a place to do something alone. That sounds very monk-like. And I'm not really sure if the monastery, like a brick-and-mortar monastery, was around at the time, but it doesn't matter because our story doesn't really go into that. What we're going to be talking about is a guy named Benedict of Nursia. This is in Italy. This dude, at a young age, was very disturbed by what he called the immorality of Roman life. I'm paraphrasing, but he was not into what was going on in the society. So at the age of 14, he gives up his studies and chooses to live the ascetic life, meaning a celibate life. Literally leaves Rome and goes to live in a cave. He goes and lives in an actual cave. He starts gaining attention for doing this, and he starts gathering followers, or quote-unquote disciples. And at some point, the following got so big that in 529, he establishes a monastery. I think it's in Italy. But what's important about this is Benedict, who's running the game here, decides to write this little book of 73 chapters. And in these chapters, he is telling people how to live the life of what will become a Benedictine monk. And of course, this book is a lot about charity and being humble. And, you know, they believe they're all going to heaven. So how to live on earth as a Christian. But there's also a good amount dedicated to administrative work, how to actually run a monastery efficiently, which we talked a lot about during the Champagne series with Dom Perignon. And this efficiency and this discipline and this administrative work will play directly into how the vineyards of Burgundy began. You see, up until the mid-10th century, almost all monasteries were staffed with secular clergy. That means that a lot of them were married. Well, that was about to come to a full stop because the Benedictine rule, this guy, this stuff was very innovative at the time within the Christian community, and it kind of caught fire. Because if you think about it, there's now literally a guidebook on how to be a monk and how to have a monastery and what to do and how to run this thing. So in 927, in the Mâconnais, in Burgundy, the Abbey of Cluny, C-L-U-N-Y, is established. The Benedictine order did not begin in Burgundy, but what did begin in Burgundy with this abbey being established was the Benedictine Reform Movement. And as of the late 10s and on, this was a religious and intellectual movement that did away with secular positions being staffed in monasteries and replaced them with celibate monks that were contemplative and follow the rules of this guideline that the guy Benedict had written. So from here on out, everyone's following the rule, what's called the rule of Saint Benedict. And with that kind of like, I mean, it's some heavy religious stuff, you know, like you have all these laymen out there and royalty that are looking at this going, wow, these monks, they have this celibate life. They don't really talk that much. They're very contemplative. They're very efficient. And because of this, the influence of the monks on society became such that people would gift or donate vineyards to these abbeys because wine was extremely popular because it was, water wasn't very potable. Wine was a big deal. These donations were also kind of securing people's position in heaven when they died because the church was so influential to people at the time. The royalty were like, here, take this. I just want to make sure that when I die, everything's good. Here, take this. And this idea of the Benedictine rule spread throughout Europe. It was in France, it was in England, it was in Germany, it was in Spain, obviously it was in Italy. I mean, England had their own kind of like Benedictine style thing, but that was overtaken at some point. The Abbey at Cluny in the Mâconnais only lasted until 1157, but the Benedictine order didn't go anywhere. And in 1232, the Duchess of Burgundy granted to Abbey Saint-Vivant the vineyards now known as Romanée-Conti, La Romanée, La Tâche, Richebourg, and Romanée Saint-Vivant. Heard of some of those before? And by 1273, this particular abbey owned all the vineyards around Gevry. Gevry-Chambertin. Sounds familiar? But something was going on here. There was some like monastery drama because in 1098, Abbot Robert Molem of the Molem Abbey in the Côte d'Or, he left the abbey with about 20 supporters. According to him and his followers, the Cluniac community, meaning the people who started the whole Benedictine reform movement, had lost or had abandoned the rigorous nature of the rule of Saint Benedict and wanted to start another society of monks. So they are donated this kind of marshland just south of Dijon, and it's an area called Citeaux, C-I-T-E-A-O-U-X, which is Old French for reeds, marshland, reeds, makes sense. Here they build a monastery, and they name their order after the property that they were donated, Citeaux. So this begins the order of the Cistercian monks. These are the guys. So Robert was considered the idealist of the abbey, but there was one of his followers, his name was Albrecht, and he was kind of the builder of the order. He was the one that helped build the whole abbey. Thing is, Robert got called back to the Clunic community, and he was like, I guess I got to do that. I don't know why, but he just left and left everything. Well, Albrecht was then elected. Now, when Albrecht becomes the abbot of this monastery, this is where things get interesting because where Robert wanted to go back to the strict, rigorous nature of that Benedictine rule, this guy was like, look, we're going to start an alliance with these royal rich people called the Dukes. He did return his community back to that rule, but still, this is very interesting. And this is how we get to one of the most famous places in wine in Burgundy and the world. Albrecht's really big accomplishment when it comes to Burgundy and vineyards and wine is he worked out a deal with the Duke Odo I of Burgundy concerning a donation of the Meursault vineyard, as well as material to build the church in that area, Meursault. See how what's happening here? All these monks are acquiring what we see today. Albrecht dies in 1108, and Steve Harding is then elected to the head of this monastery. The thing is, Robert, Albrecht, and Steve Harding were some of the original people that left that Benedictine monastery to start their own thing. And two very important things happen here. Steve made sure that he acquired as much land as possible to ensure the survival of the abbey. So even though he was wanted to go back to the rigors of the whole, you know, the Benedictine thing, he still had these alliances and was gaining land through acquisitions and donations and stuff like that. And this is what's so fascinating about the history of Burgundy, is that monks would only accept underdeveloped land that the monks would then develop on their own with their own labor. So all this Burgundy stuff, all this chaotic soil, all this stuff, it wasn't even realized until the monks gained the land and began to plant vines. And in 1110, the Cistercian monks were given a land in a commune called Vougeot, V-O-U-G-E-O-T. And it went on to require more land. And by 1336, they acquired enough land to have this big, large vineyard in this commune. And they surrounded it with a wall and called it Clos Vougeot. The Clos Vougeot, one of the most famous wine properties on the planet. From here, they bought or were given more vineyards all over the Côte d'Or. So they had a lot of vineyards. They had vineyards in Beaune, Chambolle, Ficine, Pommard, and many more. And they had to have some workers. So what they did is they had these brethren that were uneducated. That was a very particular part of it. They were uneducated in the actual, you know, rule of St. Benedict and stuff like that. They were called conversi. And this is my theory, but the word conversi sounds like conversion or to convert. So you had these, what it sounds like to me is you had these uneducated, like, people that wanted to be part of this order, but they had to go through a conversion period. And while they were doing that, they were basically free labor of the monastery. That's what it sounds like to me. They called them unconverted lay brothers, basically. And there were legions of these dudes. And as land was being acquired, the conversi were sent all over the place to help develop this thing. And this is the thing about monks, and I've been saying this a lot, but because we're talking about monks, I got to say it again. More so than anybody else, the monks had cellars and storerooms to help mature wine. They kept very meticulous records, again, Dom Perignon, and they had the time and the organization that's needed to engage in and observe and implement systematic improvement. This is the order that's sort of credited with the first Chablis. In 1128, the Cistercian Abbey at Pontigny on the River Seine had purchased some land and started making white wine there. Nowadays, it's the department of Yonne, which is where Chablis is. So that's pretty interesting. Have something to say about the wine in a second. Just in general, what was going on right now with wine. But it was these monks in this order, along with the conversi, that started to observe how different plots of vines produce different wines. And the Cistercian monks discovered how important a sense of place was and began to acknowledge different plots that had different expressions. This is the beginnings of terroir, and began to acknowledge different cru or areas that were superior to others. This would eventually be Grand Cru, Premier Cru. And this is the thing. Pinot Noir hasn't even been mentioned yet. It wasn't even called Pinot Noir. And Chardonnay wasn't even close to being around. I mean, they were around, but they were called different things or just grouped into other categories because this is where it was all beginning. They were planting vineyards and seeing what worked, doing what we call today mass selections in wine and vineyards. But they were calling, in 1283, the Pinot Noir grape was considered, well, the name was Morillon, Morillon. I'm sure they were working with that. And the Chardonnay was around, but it was grouped into other things like Aligoté, Chardonnay kind of were the same thing. The thing is, around this time, this is the 12th, we're going into the 12th and the 13th centuries. We were talking about, you know, how wine was consumed because water wasn't always potable. The thing is, white wine was the wine of the day during this time. And what's also interesting about that is monks made sure that their white wines had clarity to them because of the murkiness and the grossness of water. If you made a murky white wine, it would look like water and it would be unappetizing. So this is just like all this stuff was happening. They're planting vines, which eventually will get to Pinot Noir, will eventually get to Chardonnay and Aligoté and all that. And they were clarifying these wines so that the people that bought them enjoyed them. Not only the flavor and the aromas, but the actual visual clarity of the wine. So they didn't think they were drinking murky water. But the thing is, Burgundy had a problem. Had a transportation problem. It was kind of cut off from everything else. They could kind of get their wines to the north, but it was very dangerous. It was difficult. It was bumpy. It was muddy. And it was just not fun. So the wines were not very well known at the time in Paris. Paris, interestingly enough, was drinking wines from quote-unquote Burgundy, from the Yonne department, which is the Yonne department today, which is where Chablis is. White wine makes sense. They were drinking wines from there and calling them Vin du Bourgogne. And eventually, up until the 15th century, any wine from this area was just called Beaune, B-E-A-U-N-E. But remember the Champagne series we talked about, Clement V, who, upon his election in 1305, became the Pope and brought the papal court to Avignon, which it lasted there until 1377. Well, the Avignese popes, say Avignese because they're Italian, were notoriously extravagant and corrupt, but they really, really loved wine, and they had a they formed a liking to the wines of Beaune, and the wines of Beaune, through their preference, became regarded as second to none. This is where Burgundy's fame begins to. I don't know, the seed is planted, if you will. And even though that papacy thing comes to an end in 1377, the wines of Burgundy retained their high reputation. And there's this really interesting story here. Pope Urban, the second to last pope to do the Avignese thing, well, he actually left and went back to Rome for 3 years after the first pope had left Rome for Avignese 60 years prior. And he actually went to Rome and was like, look, this place is nuts. It's infighting, it's terrible. He was like, I don't want to be here. I don't want this. And he pieces out back to Avignon. And then he eventually dies a couple days later, really a couple days later, because he gets sick on the ship back to home. And then his successor, Gregory the 11th, becomes the last pope of this whole thing. Again, that's a whole story for another time. But that time between him leaving and getting home and dying, he receives a letter from a scholar and poet that's in Rome, kind of a guy who was part of the early Italian Renaissance, Francesco Petrarca. Some people just call him Petrarch. I don't really understand. Trying to persuade him to come back to Rome. But in that letter, he admits the best Burgundy was not to be had south of the Alps, therefore understanding why he would want to stay there. Not because of the land or the people, the wine. So a lot of things happened here, right? We have some famous vineyards being established. We have the monks doing their work. We have terroir being realized. We're starting to feel Burgundy, right? We're not done yet, but we're feeling it, right? Next week, let's talk about the Dukes. Oh my God, let's talk next week. Vine Pair Keith is my Insta. Rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps get the word out there. And now for some totally awesome credits. Wine 101 was produced, recorded, and edited by yours truly, Keith Beavers, at the Vine Pair headquarters in New York City. I want to give a big old shout out to co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon for creating Vine Pair. And I mean, big shout out to Danielle Grinberg, the art director of Vine Pair, for creating the most awesome logo for this podcast. Also, Darby Seaside for the theme song. Listen to this. And I want to thank the entire Vine Pair staff for helping me learn something new every day. See you next week.